Welcome to the Collector's Show, where you'll learn insider secrets about collecting everything. Best places to buy, how to judge authenticity, and what are the collectibles of the next generation. Here's your host, Harold Nickel.
Well, welcome to the interview segment of the Collector's Show. The collectible we're going to talk about this week is the subject of quite a bit of conversation and late night radio conversation. It is the basis of a family feud, of graves and relatives who were lost and later found, and even exhibits at some of the country's most prestigious museums, including one in a place where we used to live, Baltimore, Maryland. There are people who think these collectibles are just downright evil, while others think they open portals into other realities and demons step through them. And some people think they're just printed paper on game boards that provide some interesting opportunities for conversation. And I think that's what we'll have today with Robert Murch, who is probably the world's foremost collector, historian, and expert on Ouija boards and what are often also called talking boards or witch boards. And Robert, welcome to the Collector Show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I love to talk about Ouija, talking boards, spirit boards, and witch boards.
Now, I see, and people call you Murch, and so you don't mind if I call you Murch?
I would appreciate it if you did.
Okay, cool. Now, I see you worked as a consultant on a lot of different movies and TV shows, but before we get into this too much further, there are likely people listening who really don't know what a Ouija board is and what it's used for. If you could just give us a little bit of background.
Sure. So a talking board is the general class of these, quote, games. And Ouija is a trademark that's currently owned by Hasbro. And that is the most popular of the talking boards. But there were many different kinds. And a talking board is basically something with a flat surface that has letters and numbers, words, symbols. And it has another table on top, we call a planchette, that you would put your hands on, rest your fingers, and ask a question. The planchette would move to each one of these letters or different symbols and spell out an answer. So there's your talking board. And those first pop up being called talking boards in 1886, whereas Ouija was born in 1890.
Yeah, that's it was always interesting. My sister and I had a Ouija board when we were in elementary school, and we, you know, you put your fingers on the planchette, and I was sure that she was moving it, and she was sure that I was moving it. What do you think causes that planchette to move and give us these answers?
Well, there's three big theories. So scientists from the 1850s, long before there were talking boards, believe that what would be happening at this type of game would be something called ideomotor response. And that's the combination of two things. One, we all have muscles, and we don't want to stay still. And so they slightly move. Like, you notice some people's hands shake more than others. And when you use a Ouija board, you're also opening a door to your subconscious. So you want it to work. You ask a question. Ideomotor response is the belief that your hands and you are answering it. You just don't know it. You're playing a trick on your conscious mind. Then there are psychics who believe that what's happening is a form of telepathy, that when you sit at a Ouija board and you ask a question with someone else, you're starting to read each other's minds. And then you have people who believe that what you're contacting and what you're trying to communicate with is something other than the people playing, something different, separate, potentially a spirit or a demon or just something other than you.
It's interesting. If any of those three answers were true, it would really be cool. I had never heard the explanation about your muscles and your subconscious, and that probably makes the most sense to me. What do you think?
Well, you know, I've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of Ouija sessions by now. I've been doing this collecting and researching since 1992, and I think I've seen things that are clearly people's subconscious, and I've seen things that look like telepathy, and I want to believe, like everyone else, that there's more than just this life, that, you know, for $19.95, you get an unlimited calling plan to the other side, no roaming, no overages, the talking board could work. But I haven't still, you know, I'm still searching, and I haven't found that definite proof, but I want it to work.
Yeah, I guess I fall into that category as well. I kind of want it to work. But let's shift gears then into the actual collecting of these boards. I read on your website that you grew up liking science fiction and horror movies. But how did you connect that to Ouija boards?
Well, you know, if you looked at me today, you wouldn't know this, but I was raised an Orthodox Jew. And in any Orthodox religion, demons, spirits, ghosts, all of that is just part of your belief system. So to believe that you could talk to ghosts and spirits, it's not a big deal. There's not a leap. There's no leap of faith. And match that with the movie Witchboard coming out in 1985, 1986, where the first kind of talking board became the center, the main character. Yeah, that was pretty much, you know, what happened. And I saw the movie. It sucked me in. It made me wonder why something could be so paralyzing. Like something that was made out of plastic and paper could make people exhibit such a reaction. Mm-hmm. It's so polarizing. I thought, wow, there's something here. And what happened from there was I started researching, well, where does this come from? Where does the Ouija board come from? Everyone's got an experience with it. Everyone's got a story. Everyone knows what it is. How do we not know where it came from?
Right.
And so back in 1992, Funk and Wagnalls, I had to look in real encyclopedias. The internet was not what it is today.
Right.
And it had a different answer in every single thing. And that sent me off into a two-decade search for where are these boards? Where do they come from? And who are the people behind them? Because that's where the real story of Ouija is. It's in the people and the families that are descended from those people.
And that was really something that caught my attention, was that there's a lot of lore around these boards, but there's quite another really good story around the folks who, I guess, for lack of a better word, invented the Ouija board. Tell us about that.
Well, there's quite a few stories, and so invented is tough, so we'll frame it like this. Talking boards pop up in Ohio in 1886. We know that a company from Massachusetts, W.S. Reed Toy Company, actually made a talking board they called the Witch Board and sent it to Grover Cleveland for his wedding. So in 1886, there was a witch board in the White House.
Wow.
We don't know if he ever used it. We don't know what happened to it, but we do have those letters, so we know it existed. The board that would become Ouija was claimed to be invented by two men who worked together, Charles Kennard and E.C. Rush. And they both claimed to come up with the idea and invent the board that would become Ouija, also in 1886, in Chestertown, Maryland. Mm-hmm. And Charles Kennard would take that idea to Baltimore, where it was named almost 125 years ago. Next year is the 125th anniversary of Ouija.
Oh, cool.
Named.
What
so
is?
We're coming up on a big anniversary.
Yeah, that's interesting, and I know we'll want to talk to you about that, but what is Ouija? What does it mean? Is it a – I don't think it's an English word.
It's not. It's actually a completely made-up word. At one time, people believed it was the combination of the words oui and ja. So mm-hmm. It was a German and French combination. And it turns out that's not true. A few years ago, I came across some letters from the founders of the company that first started making it, where they credit a woman named Helen Peters, who was previously completely unknown to the story. We know the Ouija board has many fathers. It turns out the Ouija board has a mother.
Mm.
And she was a sister-in-law of Elijah Bond, who was the man who patented the Ouija board. And they were at her boarding house, sitting around the board. It didn't have a name yet, and they asked it what it wanted to be called. And according to these letters and family stories, it's spelt out O-U-I-J-A.
Oh, that's cool.
And when they asked what that meant, it said good luck. And so immediately Charles Kennard, who was a pretty smart guy, says, well, you know, like, that's interesting. And Helen Peters takes off this necklace she's wearing. And it has a picture of a woman with what she says is the word Ouija on it. So Charles Kennard wonders, were you thinking about that when we were playing? Because he kind of gets idiomotor motor response.
Mm-hmm.
And she says no. And so they adopt the word. So the word comes from the seance that took place almost 125 years ago, smack in the middle of Baltimore. And that would lead to many, many different things. As with every business, as soon as it started making money, it tore a lot of families apart, including many of the founders that were once friends. And it even impacted probably mostly William Fold, who was one of the original stockholders and original workers in the Kennard Novelty Company, the company that first made the Ouija board, and he would take it over. But it greatly affected him.
Yeah, that's something I really want us to talk about also is I don't want to say that the board brought these folks a lot of ill fortune, but I guess it did. And William Fold and several other people who were involved in the start of what was to be a very successful company, they fell out. And tell us about that. And you played a very important role in, I think, helping to resolve that. I'd like listeners to know about that as well.
Well, you know, so in 1997, I started a website. It was horrible, as every website was in 1997.
That's right.
And I had, animated GIFs. It was just horrible. But it was mine, and I did it myself, and I was at that time very proud. And one day, the granddaughter of William Fold, Kathy, wrote in. And, you know, like anything else, I was getting all kinds of crazy comments. So I said, oh, yeah, you know, you're William Fold's granddaughter, I'm the Pope.
Of course you are, yeah.
It turned out she really was. And about 2 to 3 weeks later, the grandson of Isaac Fold, Stuart, wrote in. Now, this is pretty interesting and shocking because in 1897, William Fold and his brother Isaac go into business, and they start making Ouija boards under license from the company William Fold was part of originally. That goes on from 1897 to 1901. And in 1901, when the licensing deal ends, we don't know why, but Isaac Fold is cut out of the business. And the license is given to only William Fold. And Isaac didn't like that, tried to make his own Ouija boards, which he was stopped from doing with a court injunction in 1901, continued to try to make different boards called Ouija, mostly Oriole, Baltimore Orioles. And he would do that until 1921, when it was finally decided in court that William had the right to make Ouija, not Isaac. And the family feuded from 1901 to 1997. They never spoke to each other. The feud was so large that Isaac had a daughter buried in his family plot, where all of them were buried. After the feud, he had his daughter dug up and removed to another cemetery where he then had his family set. So this was, you know, a big deal. It was money. It was ego. It was, it lasted multi-generations. It was passed down. And Kathy, the granddaughter of William Fold, I was talking to both of them, and, you know, I knew that if I told each side about the other one, I was likely to be cut off. But I became friends with both and felt I had to do it. So I told them. And one day Kathy just told me she wanted to call up Stuart and talk to him. And so this 96-year-old feud was buried one day when Kathy called up Stuart. And he had been waiting his entire life to talk to someone from the other side.
Wow.
So it was a really neat thing. And then in that year, we had the first Fold family reunion where these two sides were together again for the first time. And so it's an interesting story because the Ouija board kind of tore them apart, and then the Ouija board kind of put them back together again.
Yeah, it's really a good ending to a real sad story. And if you're angry enough to have someone, you know, dug up and moved, that's a lot of acrimony to process. And
it was a lot of court battles.
Yeah.
There was money and, again, family name. And everyone knows in a family feud, often the fights are usually over something small, but they become very large, especially when they're past your kids and then grandkids.
Yeah, yeah. And 96 years, that's a long time to stay mad.
It is a very long time to stay mad. But today that feud's over, and equally kind of interesting things have happened with all the other descendants. I was able to track down descendants from Charles Kennard, Washington Bowie, Elijah Bond. And Elijah Bond, you kind of mentioned the story that I found his unmarked grave after about 15 years of looking, and met his great-grandnephew, who was 99 years old at the time, who remembered Elijah Bond, the man who patented the Ouija board. And he gave me permission to put in a stone for him. So we, all of the Ouija and talking board collectors, got together. We raised money, and in Greenmount Cemetery, there is a monument to Elijah Bond, where on the back of the stone is his drawing, patent drawing of the Ouija board. So it is the most popular and most visited gravestone in Greenmount Cemetery. So it's a pretty neat thing to see something like that be appreciated.
And you are, I believe, the official historian for one of these families. Is that right?
Yeah, I became the official historian for quite a few of them. The Kennards, the Bonds, the Folds, the Rushes. Most recently, we discovered what we think is the only photo of E.C. Rush, the man who probably came up with the idea that became the Ouija board. And I tracked down his great-great-granddaughter. And just recently, she went back to Chestertown to see her ancestral home and where it all started. So this collecting, to me, even though I have the largest collection of boards and things that go around that, it's always, to me, been about the families and the people. So though I collect these boards, they symbolize a huge story.
Well, and that's, you know, if you think about popular culture or even American history, so many of the collections that we talk about on the program are, well, they're not as, there's not as much drama in those as there has been in this one, but you can always, you know, find a thread that goes back to our history and our culture. And you have a large collection of Ouija boards, and I wanted to ask you about planchettes. That's the integral part of the, I hate to call it a game, but I can't think of a better word at the moment. Are those important to a collection?
Yeah, they're very important. I mean, anyone who collects things knows that unless they're connected, you're likely to not have all the pieces.
That's right.
Especially if you're collecting things that go back over 100 years or even 5 years. I mean, if you look at my closet, my gosh, everything's separated.
Yeah.
So they're very important and really great when you find them. And I have a good friend named Brandon Hodge who collects planchettes as one of the pieces of his collection. Planchettes existed before the talking board. They were automatic writers. And for your listeners, if you picture a heart-shaped device with casters on the two big sides, and instead of a hole, a big hole, viewing hole, at the point, you would have a smaller hole where a pencil would go. Mm. And you would place your hand on this, and it would write out the answer. So this was, you'd ask the spirits, they would spell out an answer. Someone between when the planchette itself makes its impact in 1850, in 1886, someone takes this planchette, puts it with these other devices that have alphabet cards and boards, and the talking board is born. So it plays a very interesting part in its history, and yes, like you said, very integral to the fact that you can't make a talking board work without the indicator or
right.
planchette.
So with the planchettes and the boards, what I saw when I was getting ready for our conversation was that there are lots of different types and styles of art that are on these boards. Is that part of the appeal to collectors?
A big part. Many collectors, including myself, collected in the beginning because there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different talking boards. And the neat part of talking boards is they reflect the decade that they were made in. So you get to see what was popular at the time by what illustrations are on the talking boards. Egypt, originally, the Ouija board was called the Egyptian luck board.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you think about it, 1890, what was mystical to Americans? Egypt. There were discoveries in the Valley of the Kings, so if something was mystical, it was Egypt. And then India would add into it, so they would have, you know, the mystifying Indian board. And then you would see Swamis come in. And it's a really neat, fascinating thing. And in fact, many collectors who don't want large collections mostly collect them for the artwork. So they make great pieces on the wall. They make great pieces to start a conversation, for sure.
That's one of the things I thought about. We've talked with other folks in the past who collected, and one guy in particular who collected fruit crate labels. And a lot of the appeal of that was the artwork. And with his collection and so many other, there were groups who would get together and talk about them. Are there clubs, Ouija board collecting clubs around?
I founded the Facebook Ouija collector and talking board group.
Oh, cool.
And it's a closed group, but you can apply to come in, and, you know, we just ask a few questions about your collection. And we have over 50 people from all over the world. It's become a very worldwide thing with the push of the paranormal community. And so paranormal entertainment television is so big now that it has kind of lifted the Ouija board out of obscurity again. And so we have all kinds of new collectors, and we're meeting lots of old collectors, and they're worldwide, which is fascinating, because as I collect and I look at each kind of strain of them, Ouija has a different history in every country, often because it was licensed to different people. So Canada, and I've worked with the McMaster Library and a few museums up there, Canada has its very own Ouija history, very separate from the U.S.
That's, you know, it's like peeling an onion. But the onion here doesn't really seem to get smaller. It's like for every layer you peel back, the onion seems to grow, that there's just so much to the Ouija board and its history all over the world. And I see you're working on a new website and a book. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I'm working on a new website called talkingboards.com, and it will be every talking board that has ever been discovered and what we know about it. And it's really going to be geared towards the collector, because it will show how each board that looks similar is different. And then, you know, as other collectors see it, they'll know what they have, and they'll be able to say, well, I've got something we didn't see there. And so it'll be a huge collaboration, that's for sure, which is most of my work is collaborative, because there are so many people who have pieces of this puzzle. And then I'm working on a book with Brandon Hodge from mysteriousplanchette.com. He is a kind of seance collector and occult collector. So he likes the devices that are, he likes the boards, but he's more interested in kind of what came before it and all the different things people used to talk to spirits. And we're going to do a large book that has kind of the history of spirit communication, which Ouija and talking boards play a very heavy part, because what became different about Ouija as opposed to all the other devices was it became mass produced. So 1890 was the perfect time, and it was a fad. So, you know, Ouija boards, if you we'd want to talk about numbers, Parker Brothers and Hasbro released a number from 1967, the first full year Ouija was in production by Parker Brothers, to 2003, 13 million Ouija boards
were
made.
That's a lot.
That's just a short time. So imagine 1890 to today. So these are everywhere. So the impact for pop culture is huge. Its statement on history and a reflection of those decades really makes a big statement about America and Americana. And, you know, it's a neat thing. So hopefully this book encompasses all of that.
And I hope you'll come back and chat with us again when the book comes out. And for the moment, how can we find you?
Of course. Well, you can go to robertmurch.com. Or if you want to learn about Ouija history, you can go to williamfuld.com. I invite you to come on my Facebook page. I have a public Facebook page. So if you look up Robert Murch, you'll see it's a public page. I post daily posts about Ouija history and talking boards. And so, and my Twitter handle is Talking Boards as well. So there's a lot. And then we just founded the Talking Board Historical Society. And the first project we're going to do is, I mentioned that woman, Helen Peters, who named the Ouija board and helped. She went to the patent office as well to help make it work so that they would give the patent. She was buried in an unmarked grave in Denver. And so we just got permission to put in a gravestone for her.
Wow.
That will pay tribute to her naming and her part of the history. So once that gets listed, we'll need a lot of donations. So stay tuned for that.
We definitely will. And what an interesting conversation this week on the Collector Show with Robert Murch, who not just a collector of note, but historian and peace negotiator. Thanks so much, Murch, for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
One more quick word after this. It's the Collector's Show with Harold Nickel. Well, before we go, I was thinking about how hot it is. If you're listening to this program in real time here the last week of August, man, is it hot. And if you live in the South, like I do, man, it's really hot. And I started thinking about water guns and the kind that we used to get at the dime store. When I was a kid, you could also get them at what, in my memory, is the coolest place ever. It was a store here in Lake Jackson, where I grew up, called Sportsville, and you could buy water guns like crazy. So I started doing a little bit of research about them and found that the water gun was not a modern invention. It was invented in the 1890s, and it was supposed to be used to prevent dog and man attacks. In fact, the ad promised it will stop the most vicious dog or man without causing permanent injury, which I thought was quite a promise for a mere water gun to make. Of course, they were made of metal, so maybe that made a difference. When I looked at the collectible water guns, one of them was a Buck Rogers Liquid Helium XZ44 water pistol, and it was made by Daisy, and of course a lot of us own Daisy BB guns. This XZ44 was 7.5 inches long, and it was red, and it had yellow lightning bolts, and it was introduced in the 30s. Daisy manufactured a second Buck Rogers liquid helium water pistol, and it had a copper finish. So if you fast forward after the Second World War, and you know from listening to this show that a lot of those types of things just weren't made available or affordable during that time, the next really big supply of water guns was made in the 50s. The Reliable Toy Company of Toronto manufactured the atomic water pistol. During the war, Reliable had saved up and stored scrap plastic. And then when the war was over, it used all this leftover scrap to go into the toy business. So the atomic water pistol was bright red with a yellow trigger. It had a very, I guess, modern, futuristic look. It had a big red R pressed into the handle, and it came in a very cool box, which featured a spaceship landing on the cover. The water gun also came onto the market in 1950, and every year a new variant was added. Reliable was able to continue to sell the same basic water gun to the same kids every spring. I think all they changed was the box. So as summer winds down and you start to go back to school, think about something from when you were a kid. And if you're like me, think about your water gun and how you were able to convince your parents to buy you a new one every spring. Maybe someone from Reliable will contact you and say, thanks, I doubt it. Anyway, that'll do it for the Collector's Show for another week. Come back again for another edition of the Collector Show next week here on Web Talk Radio. I'm Harold Nicol.